This was not the theme that I had planned on speaking about. I had another whole theme addressed, and then I had a dream, an extremely powerful dream. And in the dream, I knew it was me. I knew I was Atum, a man with a male body, but I was enormously pregnant. I was so pregnant, it's beyond what any human body could hold. And I knew I was just about to give birth. And I wasn't even worried about how that was going to happen, which was pretty amazing. It's kind of the divine trust. But it is very interesting that Atum, the name Pirvalaya gave me, one of the meanings is, as far as I know, he is the only male creator god that creates the creation out of himself with his semen. So it had a little echo of something, shall we say. And what happened during the birth is this vastness, this incredible vastness opened up. And then out of it emerged something. And I realized in this profound way what emerged was you. You, the community. I mean, I know there has been a community. And I have felt my deepest calling, what I'm was called to do and asked to do these past several years, was build. So when people ask me, why do you travel so much? I've gotten directions. And my directions were, this is your time to build. So I have gone from group to group, well over 30 groups now, building this piece. But I never actually kind of felt the totality of what has emerged until I did in the dream. I've been concerned about getting the different groups together, and then some groups wanted to go on more, and then we've developed advanced programs and then international gatherings and on. So it has been an enormous building phase. And in the dream, it's like I stopped and saw, oh my gosh, look what's been built. Look what has been built. And that's us. And we're a representation of about maybe there are like 600 more of us that have gone through this kind of training in various places. So there's a community that has emerged. And that's what the dream made me aware of. Now, in the Buddhism, you look at the question, what were the conditions that enabled the community to come forward? And as the dream was ending, I heard the words that come from Meister Eckhart, words I have repeated many times. Are you willing to be the object of God's desire? And I realized at that moment from the dream, and as I worked with the dream, that's what's happened to me. I have been the object of God's desire. God wanted to create something, or the universe wanted to unfold something. And I certainly was not aware of that in the very beginning when the intention was placed. And that dream about the birth was a representation of what that divine desire was that somehow got planted in me has reached a point of rich fulfillment. So then it made me look back at my life. Where did that divine desire start? Where did it get planted in me? Where did I first become conscious of it? Now, a question I lived with for a number of years is, why me? I don't even mean about this particular further development of the piece, but why me? You know, I'm an average guy, I'm American, grew up in an Irish Catholic family. Why me did I meet a Sufi teacher when I didn't even know what the word Sufi meant, and I had never heard of him? And I arrived at this place like Parsifal at the Knights of the Round Table, completely innocent and somewhat of the fool. And within 1 week, he said to me, you will do the same work that I am doing. And when I encountered him carrying a heavy parcel, and I said, can I help you? And he said to me, not with the parcel, but you can help me carry my soul. It is a very heavy soul. It has lots of souls in it. You will have to become strong like St. Christopher. Now, I had only known this man 5 days. You can imagine, you arrive at this place, I don't know anything about the orientation, and you're told those things. Now, they were seeds. I never did then develop a strategy and a plan to become, to do the same work he did or something like that, or to end up helping him carry his soul. But in that initial 2 meetings in the course of 5 days, really set the whole trajectory of the rest of my life. That started it. That's some place where the divine desire that God implanted in me first expressed itself through the words of Pure Reliant. A couple of years later, I met Reb Zalman. Reb Zalman, and when I met him then, was about as opposite as from Pure Reliant as I could imagine. Scared me to death. And I had a dream the night I met him in which he said, "I've come to help you become who you really are." So Reb Zalman was my kind of Shams. You have Rumi, you know, in a certain way of being, and then he encounters someone quite the opposite in the Shams figure, which is transforming. So those figures, first of all, one of the things that happened with Pure Reliant is after he told me those 2 things, years later, I ended up as the Secretary General in the Sufi Order, and my initial reservation of following him as a teacher was I did not want to be a part of any organization. And there I was in the key role of the organizer in the organization. What I realize in retrospect is it gave me the possibility of seeing how all of that works. It was a preparation that put me into that situation to look at it from a whole different vantage point than someone who was a student. I saw another whole dimension of it. And what it also gave me in my relationship with Pure Reliant is I followed the traditional path that the disciple goes with the teacher. I went from the enormous idealization stage to the stage that Hasudanayakan speaks of, in which the student discovers the human proportions of the teacher, which of course have always been there, but you don't see them in the idealization phase. And then to a place of what Hasudanayakan says is the completion of the journey where you become 2 friends. And I really felt like that's the place where Pure Reliant and I ended up. And one has gratitude toward the teacher for helping you to have made that journey and that transformation. And also, I think the teacher, certainly in my case, has gratitude for the people that you have guided, because you're both transformed in the process. So I had that ability to make that enormously long journey over about 37 years and go through all of those traditional stages that are earmarked, many more than I can mention now. And I have incredible gratitude for Pure Reliant for so many things. As Taj mentioned, all the doors that he opened in her life. Well, so much of what I do today, Pure Reliant was the doorway through which I first saw it, who encouraged me to go through the doorway, and that has shaped my life. Also, from a good teacher, you learn what not to do. And one of the things I learned from Pure Reliant's mission, from my perspective, was not to be the head of an order. He always felt constrained by that whole organizational piece. It was his cross. And he carried it out of dedication to his father. But his real message was to be a seed thrower, to throw out all the seeds of the message. And he reached many more people than his father. He reached tens of thousands of people, and he planted the seed in all of their hearts about the message. That was his purpose from my perspective. And he accomplished it in the most profound and incredible way, with every ounce of life in him dedicated to that. But when I went to see Pure Reliant toward the end of his life, it's a tender moment, because it was a moment when I saw him in the deep vulnerability of his aging. And aging was not easy for Pirulai. Someone who wanted to live beyond any constriction, as we all know in this room, aging is not easy. And we were supposed to meet, and nobody could find him. And then when he came back, he looked embarrassed and very fatigued. His knees had given out on his walk, and he had to sit down somewhere and wait until they would work again. And he lay down. He said, do you mind if I lay down, Atum? I said, no, Pirulai, fine. So he lay down, and I held his hand, and we talked, told me his latest inspirations. And I said to him, you know, I've really come. I don't want anything, Pirulai. I just want to tell you the ways that you have affected me and my life. And he was so stunned. I mean, this is a man I also worked intimately with for 12 years. He was so stunned that he had affected my life. And I could see it was true. I mean, it wasn't a kind of graciousness. Pirulai can be overly polite sometimes. I could see he was like really shocked. And then I thought, if you don't know how much you've affected my life, you have no idea how many people's lives you have affected. And that was always my dream for Pirulai, that when he died, there was a moment where he saw. He saw all the thousands upon thousands of souls that he planted the seed in, and how that seed was germinating and unfolding. But I knew at that moment that that's not what I wanted at the end of my life. I wanted to know the people I work with. I wanted to have watched the transformation. I wanted to be able to affirm that and to have been a really deep, rich part of their personal journey. And that's why this form is much more my form. It has to do with a certain kind of calling. And I'm going to introduce a practice to our community later that has to do with the good seed, the watering of the good seed, the cultivation of the good seed, and the harvesting of the good seed. I want to be around for a small group of people for all four. That's my very deep desire. Now, what I got from Zalman was a similar thing. I made a very full journey with Zalman. And Zalman was much more conscious of the passage. So Zalman really orchestrated the movement from the idealized phase into a relationship phase, into a friendship phase, and then into peers working together. So in the latter years of our meeting, we would come together and there would be a phase for, he'd say, well, I want to tell you my piece now, what's going on with me. You tell me your piece, and then we'll talk shop, what's happening for you in your work and what's happening for mine. And he gave me a lot of teaching. He showed me how to do all kinds of things, how to do blessings. He took me and showed me how to do weddings from his perspective. He took me on. Now, I was an Irish Catholic Sufi. I was never born Jewish. So again, the question comes up, why me? He became my advisor in graduate school, which was actually, this is an enormously busy man to take a graduate student on and to give me all of that attention. And I used to think, why me? And also described me as a chosen son. As a chosen son. Why me, once again? Why did he move to Philadelphia, where I happen to live, to teach at Temple University? Why did he show me a lot of the psychological pieces that Pirulai hadn't explored in the role? How did he, that he would show me, which in a personal way, many of his rabbis that studied with him didn't get that chance for one-to-one personal space. So there, that's a question that I've lived with. I've also lived with the question when I went to the Guild for Spiritual Guidance. I went there because Pirulai had asked me to help be in charge of the training of guides in the Sufi order, and I thought I better find out what other traditions are doing. And I went, and this beautiful man, now these are all bridge people, notice this. This beautiful man, I mean, bridging to other traditions, bridging to other groups, etc. John Youngblood was this amazing combination of the two poles of Christianity, an Episcopal priest and a Quaker. I mean, you put those two together, that's phenomenal. In his being. And he was the director of the spiritual guidance program since it started. And for some very amazing reason, he put my name in to succeed him after he got Parkinson's, which I could have fallen on the floor when he told me that. I mean, there were 2/3 of the group were ministers and priests, etc. Again, the question, why me? I mean, people he knew a lot longer, why me? And I'll address a little later what he said to me when it became evident. The board of directors, when they interviewed me, it was a very beautiful interview. And then they were in that kind of, you know, very nice Christian way, said, well, we have one question maybe you could help us with. How could we explain you? And then we both knew, it's not going to work. You know, John went to seminaries, etc., and spoke in places like that. But there again, why me? You know, people who are much more involved in that community. And then I met Frances. And Frances, the woman in the founding period of transpersonal psychology. And I ended up, as you saw, in a beautiful relationship with her. Who could I have found, if I consciously went out and looked for, who knew more about what goes on in spiritual groups and with spiritual teachers than Frances? She's been brought into group after group after group in crisis. She has been the therapist of spiritual teachers from across the traditions. She has worked with lots of people in various phases. I couldn't have found someone who had a better understanding of the dynamics that go on there and could hold that for me as I consciously went through the process and reflected larger pieces about it and a refuge. And also, I put together a conference with Jack Engler, Francis Vaughan, and Pierre Vilayet in Boston. And I learned my way of teaching from Francis. Because Pierre Vilayet got up, which would be Pierre Vilayet's way, and Pierre Vilayet, in an hour and a half, tried to give everything he had ever learned. You know, it's the cosmic teaching of Pierre Vilayet. And I turned around and looked at the audience, and people were like, really, they were just completely overwhelmed, like, oh. It was, you know, the universe, like, just flooded into you. Where do you start? Where do you start? And then Jack Engler came up, and I asked him to speak because he had written this exquisitely beautiful piece about the relationship between stages of early development in childhood, schizophrenia, and mystical experiences. And at Harvard, he's in charge of the Clinic for Schizophrenics. And it is unbelievably clear and precise. So he mapped out these three stages and all these pieces, was enormously articulated, much more focused than Pierre Vilayet. And then I turned around and looked at the audience, and then they were all like, it's vast. I get it. I mean, it's just vast. It's clearly articulated. Where would one ever start as a therapist, as a spiritual guide? And Francis was the last presenter. And Francis looked at the audience, and she had a sense of what they could digest. And she gave them no more or no less than what they could digest. And at the end, when I turned around and looked at the audience, everybody was in their body, in themselves, and they had a sense of where to begin and what they could do. And I knew at that moment what it demonstrated for me is actually my love is more for people than it is for traditions. I'll take anything from any tradition that will work for the person before me. Now, other people love traditions more than people. And I'm not saying either one is better. You just need to know your own way. So for me, Francis also modeled that at that moment. It's the people that I'm concerned with. And then I had a meeting with Helen Luke. Now, when I was 27, I went to the Jung Institute. It's the same summer I met Pure Vilayat in Zurich. The person who was the dean of the institute took me around and spent 3 hours with me. I was a long-haired hippie then. She spent 3 hours with me, and then she said to me, "You don't want to come here. Do something with your life." Really, I mean, you know, sometimes you just get very direct. She said, a lot of people come here and they watch the ivy grow in Zurich. Do something with your life. Now, I knew Jung would be a profound influence in my life, but she made it very clear I needed to do it a different way. So I knew about Helen Luke's work, was a Jungian analyst, worked with Robert Johnson for 25 years and then started her own community. I knew of her. I thought she was dead. I had read her pieces in Parabola, and I got to meet her. I only had 2 meetings with Helen Luke. One was an hour and a half. And actually what happened in that meeting, in the very beginning, she said to me, "I only had 1 meeting with Carl Jung." And I came with a question. And Carl Jung never answered the question. He never gave me time to ask the question. I was English. I had grown up in England. I lived there my whole life. And all he talked about was the difference between the American psyche and the English psyche. And I sat there the whole time thinking, why is he telling me this? 6 months later, she moved to America and never returned to England. He gave her exactly the piece that she needed. And I thought, when she said that in the first 10 minutes, remember everything she says in this meeting. Really. Because we're just repeating it. She's Jung and I'm Helen, and here we go. And it's true. Everything she said to me in that meeting turned out to shape a huge change in my life. And one of the things that she said to me, I asked her about Jungian analyst, and she smiled because she lived in the nowhere place. I mean, literally nowhere. And she said with a smile, not with grandiosity, it was actually a paradox. She said, "Somehow they make it all to my door," meaning the Jungian analyst. And she said, "I'll tell you what I see, is most of them have lost their inner life for the role." What a gift, because at that moment I had all kinds of titles in the Sufi order. And that's a kind of moment for me where something began to individuate out of the Sufi order. And to really look at titles and roles was an enormously important meeting for me. But I got one better than Helen did with Jung. At the very end, desperate was still that question, I finally got to ask her, "What is spiritual guidance?" And that's when she had a long pause and she said to me, "Meeting, just as we have done." And out of that came the practice that we have just done. Now, again, that I got to meet Helen Luke, who the Jungians hold as a kind of touchstone because she has lived it in such a deep way, was an enormous gift. And the great surprise when I called to make an appointment with her, she answered the phone. And she told me huge pieces of her life story. And actually, from her, I learned that I had a masculine model of enlightenment, which I always had from my previous experiences or teachers, etc., seen as transcendence. And I saw enlightenment as being enormously present in life. Through Helen Luke, it offered a different piece. So now, His Holiness Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, once again, I was Parsifal coming into King Arthur's court. I had no idea who Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche was. And I actually didn't want to go to meet him because I was exhausted from co-leading a pilgrimage with Pirlide in India of 130 people. And I kept thinking, the last thing I want to do is to meet a holy man, let me tell you. And I arrived there, and I had no idea who he was. I had his name and a piece of paper. Someone had set up a private appointment. And I went, and they brought me into this huge room. And I went up to the secretary, who was actually Matthew Ricard, and I said, excuse me, but I'm a tomb, and someone set up an appointment for me. He said, oh, yes, we've been expecting you. And told me to sit down, and I heard all this laughter from behind these curtains. He said, he's eating lunch now. He'll see you right afterwards. And so I heard all this laughter, and then I saw people back out and do all these prostrations before they left. And I thought, I will never learn that well enough in the next 5 minutes. So I went and said, excuse me to him. There's no way I can do that really well. He said, oh, well, don't worry about it at all. And the Western nun who took me there, because I just had this piece of paper, I couldn't say his name, she happened to come back and sit next to me. Really being Parsifal, the total fool, I leaned over and said, this is a very embarrassing question, but who is he? Really. You know, she kind of looked at me, you know, she never lost that kind of Buddhist equanimity. And she said, well, he's the head of one of the four Tibetan orders, and he's a teacher of the Dalai Lama. I really didn't get that. I mean, I really didn't get it because I was so kind of amazed by what was going on. And then they opened the curtains and they brought me in. And I always thought Tibetans were about this big. And he was about this big. And he was huge and an androgynous body. He was in his 80s. And here again, totally the fool. I saw him, and he was such a complete ocean of love that I just wrapped my arms around him. Now, only later did I find out from my Buddhist teacher friends, you did what? I could not have done otherwise. He was the embodiment of divine love. And he was an ocean. I just had to put my arms around him. And the monks were like twittering, but I didn't even get it. They were like... and then he said some things to me, and the only thing I remember was he said to me, your teacher and you have great power. Now, power for me has always been a shadow quality. Of all the things that he said, the fact that he named power has made me come back and look at my relationship power again and again because I enormously respect what he said. He has never left my being. When I walked out of there, I had met the ocean of divine love. I had experienced luminous consciousness. And I knew what the archetype of the full moon was as an archetype. Because I said to Matthew, all I could say to Matthew was full moon. Full moon. I just met the full moon. And he started laughing and he said to me, well, that's his given name, the full moon. So I met the reality of the full moon. Now, why me? A couple of years later, I told this story in a teaching program with Joan Halifax and Baker Roshi. And they both looked at me like, do you have any idea what happened to you? And they said to me, you know, many, many Buddhists consider him the Buddha of our time. And you also know that he's the one who started to bring the four groups together, give initiations among the four groups in which there were, the four lineages, in which there was a lot of competition and judgment, etc. Now, then I found out there were thousands, tens of thousands of people around the world who were his disciples. I got a personal meeting. I've met many disciples who never got a personal meeting. Why me when I found that out? I mean, they were real students. Why me? Now, I go to Bhutan practically every year now because of His Holiness Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. And while we've been there, we've met his reincarnation. And they thought I was a student of him because when I saw the first statue of him, I said, I know him! I couldn't help it. And then they assumed that we were all students and we've gotten into places that tourists can't get. So I am a student of him, of His Holiness. On the inner level, I get practices from him. I get insights from him. He's enormously present. But the question came back to me again and again, why me? The dream answered that for me. I mean, I gave up with struggling with the question a while ago because it's a mystery. But now the dream gave me an answer. Why me? Because of you. Because of you. It was all preparation. It was a divine desire placed in me that something wants to unfold. And having those experiences with all those figures created the coming together of all kinds of streams and the preparation about what a spiritual community can be and the difficulties and the dangers within the role of a teacher. I mean, I had enormous preparation from some of the greatest teachers in our time. And it all had the intention of creating what we have created together. Not me, but what we have created together. So we're a very small, minuscule fragment of the world population, but the divine intention has something for us to do. It brought us together for a reason. So I normally don't write my presentations, but I was in an airplane. Yeah, that's where I spend a lot of time. And this is what came. So I'll just read. This is my only written piece. Imagine a Paris cafe has emerged out of the dark, infinite, cold space of the universe. That's a comment by a character in a Woody Allen film called Midnight in Paris. Well, imagine we as a community have also emerged. We did not exist 25 years ago. Out of some mysterious divine intention, we've been gathered together to explore the archetypal worlds, weave our hearts together, and journey together, create soul friendships, and serve the spirit of guidance at this critical time. We have supported each other as we mutually enlarged our lives and consciousness. We have lived Rumi's prayer, oh, for a friend to mingle his soul or her soul with mine. What has emerged from our coming together has transformed our relationships with our families, friends, work, ourselves, and the worlds in which we live. We, like countless groups spread throughout this wondrous and amazing world, are serving as birth coaches, and midwives in the emergence of a greater consciousness. In the very fabric of our lives and psyche, the spiritualization of matter and the materialization of spirit has been occurring. What is unfolding in us and others serving this awakening is the infusion of the divine consciousness into humanity and the humanizing of the divine in the grand alchemical marriage. The dream that Martin Luther King invoked is now extended to the whole planet. He gave voice to the spiritual evolution being propelled by the soul of humanity. Reb Zalman many years ago said to me, in the history of our earth, there are only a few times like ours. What a blessing to be incarnated now. He was referring to our privilege of serving the arising of planetary consciousness and the further individuation of the soul of humanity, acting in and through us. In alchemy, there must be glue that unites, sustains, and guides a community, that holds it together. For our community, it is the archetype of the spirit of guidance, and this new awakening that coagulates in us. In the integration of the opposites needed to bring mature spiritual community, there must be a balance of union and enough spaciousness to accommodate the uniqueness of each person and their journey of individuation. I pray that you have found both in this community.